Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, returning for the last episode of 2022, in which we're covering the unsolved murders of Patricia Mann and Jesse McBain. But first, I want to say thank you to everybody who has supported the show this year, from my Patreon supporters to Kickstarter people to those leaving positive ratings and reviews on platforms like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. I think the one thing I've noticed more than anything else about podcast listeners in more than 5 years of producing this show is that the people who care and are supportive, even if it's for other shows and not mine, are the people who tend to seem like they're actually happy or at least fighting for happiness and living decent lives. If you're one of those people, again, whether your support goes to my show or someone else's or even many people's work, thank you for having the courage and conviction to create a positive environment in which we can examine the human condition while being vulnerable, because that's what this is really all about, what's inside our hearts and minds. But more importantly, bringing it to life and sharing in the process of both grieving and celebrating our humanity in a world equally ugly and beautiful, equal parts love and loss. The other day, as I finished a 16-hour session rewriting a feature film script, I happened to scroll through a few of my recent reviews on Apple Podcasts. Now, I've had the same rating on Apple Podcasts for over 5 years, even right down to the decimal point. My Spotify rating has actually gone up. I am polarizing, but in the most predictable way, and so, like I said, right down to the decimal, I've had the same rating on Apple Podcasts since 2017. Then along comes a coward who hides behind anonymous reviews and could absolutely never summon the courage to create anything requiring public scrutiny to assert that the reviews of my podcast are increasingly poor, and she knows why. If my rating has not changed in more than 5 years from a factual standpoint, then I know whatever comes out of her mouth next is going to be equally stupid. And here it is. She listened to an episode from 2021 in which I talk about the protagonist of the event in the context of refusing to change when she needs to, and this person has now had an epiphany she finds brilliant, but couldn't be any more ridiculous. I have said on many occasions that this show is what it is, and it is intended to be a rough first draft, whether an episode is 1 hour or 6 hours. That has always been my intention, and not ever have I intended to make a highly produced and edited product, because quite simply, I have so many other things I'm working on that require a tremendous amount of my attention. I don't have the time, energy, or desire to do that and have articulated my intentions in that way so that everyone can understand why I do what I do. I have multiple creative projects, from screenplays to TV pilots to animation, that demand every bit of my attention, and in one very specific way: change. My life is nothing but one giant revision, as I am constantly creating, analyzing, editing, and refining in a process that isn't likely to end until I'm dead. Yet this person wants to assert, by way of listening to a podcast episode, that she has had this amazing epiphany in which I haven't undergone true analysis, only self-analysis, and partial at that, leaving me completely ignorant of the fact that the podcast and its associated image are screaming for change. Lady, that's the fucking point. The podcast is about what I can do to change you, as I, in my other endeavors, am up to my fucking eyeballs in nonstop change that requires me to, on a regular basis, kill my babies, so to speak. This podcast is not one of those babies. It is not intended to change. It is not going to grow up and mature. I am not hoping it will suddenly become something more, and I have articulated that over and over again. I have gotten the attention of everybody from soccer moms to celebrities by being this person. And furthermore, I am fucking sick of the bullshit neurodivergent people have to tolerate because of those like you. We have special interests. We ramble. And if you don't like it, go fuck yourself. Find a different podcast. Hide behind your anonymous reviews and continue to insult people who are, by leaps and bounds, far more analytical and intelligent than you are. My work will never appear in an anonymous review because I am not a coward. Please, if you are one of these ignorant cowards, just think about how miserable you have to be to anonymously insult and poorly review a creative just prior to Christmas because you've decided he's done you wrong. I have not done anything wrong. I make this show as is for the thousands of people who want to hear it every week, and when I succeed at my creative projects outside of it, which require mind-blowing amounts of introspection and change, I will thank those amazing people for not being assholes, sticking with me, believing, and most of all, realizing that trying to hold people down to make them like you, or make them exactly what you want instead of what they are, only results in drowning yourself. The cowardice of some of these people is beyond shocking, and the stupidity is something I can't even reconcile against reality. It's this simple. If you look at an episode preview and it's 3 hours, you might want to skip to another of the 200 episodes I've made that is shorter. And by utilizing that logic, guess what? You can avoid what you don't like. But instead of changing, you've decided you've figured out my life by listening to a single podcast episode. Being subjected to rude assholes like this is annoying, but knowing that they're stupid means creators pay the price. So to that reviewer and the other cowards who don't and can't create and only criticize because they have miserable, fearful, and empty lives, my listeners and I will see you at the finish line of this race, and your dumb ass will be begging us to watch you clap while we finally celebrate the victory. I went into this thinking that I could make this interesting, but never realized how many people would thank me for saying something that made a difference in their lives, that changed their lives, even in the smallest way. I have made a difference in the hearts and minds of human beings, so to marginalize my efforts by pointing out that your perceived shortcomings of my neurodivergence demand reflection and change is selfish, disgusting, and indicative of an ironic truth I can see right through the imaginary wall you've put between us to protect yourself, which is that you, and not I, are the one who needs to change, so shut the fuck up and listen.
Anyhow, moving along. Patricia Mann, known as Pat, was a petite, attractive woman with blonde hair, very typical of the 1971 version of the young woman who garners lots of media attention today in these cases. Pat was a 20-year-old nursing student, one who trained at Watts Hospital in Durham, North Carolina, while her boyfriend, 19-year-old Jesse McBain, a student athlete at NC State, was a football player. Basically, Pat was the type to have many male admirers, and Jesse was exactly the type of boyfriend those admirers love to hate. If we brought 1971 into today, Jesse was basically a Chad, a tall, good-looking, and popular guy with a heightened social status afforded by the masculinity of the sport in which he participated. For Jesse, as a teen guy, going off to NC State was eye-opening in the best way, meaning there were tons of girls concentrated in the same place, and even better, a lot of them were interested in him. That's an ideal situation for a male. As a guy, you don't worry about the bad intentions of these women. They aren't going to kill you if you don't sleep with them, or stalk you at night outside your bedroom window. At least in most cases. And even if they did, Jesse was a big dude and could likely crush any woman who had the courage to try. So for guys, this is generally a very pleasant experience, one in which rejecting a girl doesn't lead to murder. In fact, some of these young guys are more than happy to sleep with most, if not all, of these women, so there's not much negativity to be found in these situations most of the time, unless an unstable woman is involved on the other side of the fence. On the other hand, young women exist in a world in which the male gaze can leave every man looking like a dangerous predator. And as we all know, hunting has a strong correlation to sexuality, as mates, for a long time, and still to this day, in a financial way, are more inclined to revere successful hunters. The sociopath, however, simply turns the tables on the woman and makes the joke on her when her rejection leads him to showing he can successfully hunt, even game like her, so to speak, as he proceeds to stalk and kill her. And so since his emotional approach is not working, it becomes a physical one so that he can manifest images of him hunting her. A man is simply displaying his hunting skills to deliver ironic fate in such a circumstance. It's like, oh, you don't think I'm worthy of having you in the context of being a hunter? Okay, fine. Then what I'll do is prove I can take what I want by hunting you. So what he cannot accomplish emotionally, meaning getting her to submit, he does physically. It's an assertion of dominance, but manifested by force of physicality, meaning that the woman, or that which is hunted, doesn't submit willingly. And that's the difference between being the father, so to speak, and being everyone else who is not. The father dominates her will and breaks her emotionally so that she surrenders her body. For the sociopath, however, it's only physical, and therefore, what we really hunt, when successful, is the mind, the emotional world of the prey. And in doing so, even if just sitting up in a tree, camouflaged from a deer while holding a rifle, we see that the hunter indulges the psychology of the creature prior to any physical submission on the other end. The sociopath in society is enraged because he cannot assert emotional dominance over a woman, leading to physical submission. So instead, he manifests it all physically, forcefully putting her in a place of submission. A man receiving emotional acceptance and/or submission by a woman is just like the stalker in the sense that he's thinking of ways to prey on her, get her alone, and break her will. But this process happens emotionally inside his head. As a stalker has no such option, he takes it out of his head and into the physical world, in which there are places he can follow her, break her, and ultimately get what he wants, taking the long way around, finding the emotional satisfaction of finally dominating and overcoming his prey. So, on February 12, 1971, Jesse and Pat are a young couple who have been together for several years, but are barely out of high school. And as it was back then, Jesse has already given Pat something called a pre-engagement ring, which today might be more often described as a promise ring. He was committed to her, and she to him, but in the same way Jesse had female admirers at college, Pat had them at Watts Hospital. In fact, the top three suspects in this case all worked with Pat, and at one point, all admitted, in some way or another, they wanted her. On this particular weekend, Jesse learns that the car he shares with his brother, which is normally the brother's to drive on that night, as they split the weekends, is going to be available to him instead, which is great because he's planning to take Pat to a dance in the basement of the nursing dormitory. Pat, meanwhile, doesn't realize the potential change in plans yet. She's taking a nursing exam at the hospital and meticulously checking her answers as her friend waits to give her a ride home to meet Jesse. The friend finishes her exam much earlier than Pat, while Pat claims she needs perhaps another half hour, something that seems to baffle her friend. One has to wonder if something was going on that made Pat decide to refuse the ride, like something she had to take care of that she didn't want her friend to know. To this day, the friend finds Pat's pace on the test very odd. So she ends up leaving on her own, and Pat stays. Meanwhile, Jesse surprises Pat by showing up in his car, meaning she won't need to go home to meet him now. The two of them can just go to the dance at the nursing student's dormitory that night. So they show up for this Valentine's Day event and stay the course, meeting with about 50 other people, mostly nursing students and their significant others, at what is sometimes described as a dance and other times a mixer. These were innocent affairs as far as we know, no drugs or alcohol of which we're aware, and everybody seems to have gotten along. Basically, it's just a group of people, a punch bowl, some music, snacks, and dancing. So when the couple left the dance on the night of the 12th, things got interesting. Jesse, as I said, is noticing other girls at school are into him, and more importantly to a young man's mind, they're interested now, as in instant gratification, something that naturally coincides with the immediacy of sexual desire. Plus, there are numerous women who fit this mold for him, so when he looks at Pat, someone who wants to be a virgin until marriage, he's sort of put in a situation where he wants this sex, but his girlfriend isn't ready, and it's irreconcilable against his desires, leading to conflict between the two. Things like this are common, and were especially common back then. Knowing about the other girls, Pat will feel pressure to accommodate, and Jesse will take advantage by trying to get her to submit. Just as it was many moons ago, with multiple women vying for the attention of the same revered hunter, the threat of submission by another woman, or many, can induce urgency in the chosen one to submit now. Guys basically say, in a crude way, put out or get out, which is not fair in modern society, but nonetheless still effective at precipitating sexuality in stubborn mates. But this couple really has nowhere to go after the dance. Pat can't have Jesse in the nursing dorm, and Jesse's place is back at NC State. So like most people back then, and even to a certain extent today, they drove somewhere that they could park, specifically what was known back then as Lover's Lane. Lover's Lane was a generic term for the places people like these teens would go to park to go about their sexual business that couldn't be indulged in other places with no privacy. The car serves as a mobile bedroom, basically, and it's a good idea, at least until the people who aren't getting laid find out, and next thing you know, you have Zodiac putting bullets in their heads to accommodate the hunting he couldn't succeed at socially and sexually. By parking at such places, you might as well advertise yourself as sexually and socially successful, even potent and desired, leaving those who aren't getting it literally looking at you from the outside in. And so, as the emotional idea of being kept on the outside looking in and prevented from becoming the father sets in, people with mental illness begin to think in the context of being the father by way of the following question, but in relation to the car, instead of the woman's heart, mind, and genitals, because those things include her autonomy. So he asks the question in relation to the car, how do I get inside? In lieu of the stiff straight line of the penis and ejaculating semen succeeding sexually within the car, Zodiac uses a gun that shoots death rather than creation, as he is trying to kill the father, so to speak, to replace him and also kill the prey in lieu of sexual dominance. In the end, the only person left alive, aka the father, disappears, just like the murderer. In fact, the reason there are so many absent fathers in society is that all of our evolutionary failures are based in the absence of God or the Father, and so problems related to transcendence, especially among men, can be traced back to that in one way or another. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. During times we're cruising through life and finding the answers and resources we need to move forward, it can seem like nothing could possibly go wrong. We have the solutions we need. And then, just as quickly, a new problem arises, perhaps a different kind of challenge, and we sometimes find ourselves stuck. That's when we realize there's really no user manual for life, no perfect set of instructions we can follow. So where do we turn when finding ourselves here? Thankfully, BetterHelp Online Therapy is here to assist. They can help navigate the multitude of various challenges life brings our way, from parenting concerns to relationship worries to a change in career. In my experience, therapy is a great choice as it can address everything from recognizing trauma to developing healthy coping skills. As the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online. Plus, it's affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be simpler. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. Learn more and save 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/CCMM. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/CCMM. So Jesse and Pat drive over to the nearby Crowsdale neighborhood, which began construction about 5 years earlier in 1966 and included plans for a country club with a golf course, as well as an entire neighborhood. It was a development. Yet in 1971, while the golf course was there and construction was long since underway, the enormity of the project meant that it was still mostly incomplete. Many new roads were either in the process of having homes built upon them or were scheduled to have more construction in the near future. Basically, road construction making way for home builders meant that the roads would obviously precede the homes and that, at least for a while, people could park on streets or in front of homes that, for all intents and purposes, were not occupied yet, making it a great place to, ironically, find privacy in public. Now, in this neighborhood, what began to happen is that young couples would go back there to park, people exactly like Jesse and Pat, who had nowhere else to go. The point of going to a place like this is privacy, and so most people heading there didn't call back over their shoulders to mom and dad that they would be going to the Crowsdale Hotel, as it was called by some. Of course, that nickname suggests the place had garnered an appropriate reputation. But as it goes with anything else, when finding what is an oasis for some, others will indulge the opposite and ruin it. Young couples getting some, so to speak, wanted privacy, and what soon became routine is for people not getting any, especially guys, to go to the Crowsdale Hotel to terrorize and interrupt those who were. But even though most of these carloads of male pranksters were indulging revenge for their emotional misery against the hunters having more success and the prey that submitted to them instead, the majority were clearly not violent. They were envious, even jealous, just like Zodiac, yet instead of using violence to insert their stiff, straight, disappearing line into the car in the form of bullets to compensate for not being able to do it with the penis, guess what these guys use instead? If you're in a car at night How do you generate a long, straight, disappearing line of white light that will go right through the car and literally enlighten the victims about your emotional pain? The headlights. If two people are making out in a car, you pull up behind them and stick your big, stiff, straight white line right in their faces with a length and power that makes them cringe, realizing they're the target. You're dominating them. Putting a red laser dot on a gun scope is intended for the same thing. So, as notorious as the Crowsdale Hotel becomes for people getting it on, it becomes equally popular for losers coming around trying to stop them. It mimics the feeling a man has when a superior man comes along and steals the attention of a specific female, which breaks up your chance with her. That happens emotionally on a regular basis to beta males. So the revenge, as one cannot get revenge on another person who doesn't want them emotionally, is simply physical. Now, most of the time, kids would do this to other teens and drive away. The nature of their revenge isn't rooted in violence and elimination like it would be in the wild. It's rooted in making the people who are hurting you in ignorance aware of it. Anyhow, someone seeking greater acknowledgement or validation would indulge that symbolism to a much more harrowing conclusion. Now, think of these streets Jesse is driving along. What are they in this moment? They are the pathway to him getting inside Pat, and his car, like a penis, is the vehicle for doing that. So due to symbolic necessity, a circumstance will transpire that metaphorically utilizes the vehicle as a penis entering and then remaining inside or parking inside a vagina. So we ask ourselves, of all street constructions, which one perfectly mimics a vagina leading to a womb? That, of course, would be a cul-de-sac. Now, a cul-de-sac is simply a passageway that is closed on one end, so it fits the anatomy perfectly. Now, if you were jealous of Jesse putting his thing inside Pat, and the penis is symbolized by a car, what would you do to become the father here, visually? Well, we already know, by way of the pranksters, you'd come right up behind them in your car. But if you wanted to symbolically emasculate the superior man, aka father, and get him out of the woman, how would you do it? Well, you'd take the father from the car, essentially and symbolically removing the penis, and then you would lead him out of the cul-de-sac or vagina so that he was no longer inside Pat, aka the car, and no longer had his penis attached. Of course, that says he isn't the father anymore, and there's room for someone else. But if he becomes the father, then symbolically the couple must become the children. So what we should expect at this point is for a man in a car to come along, abduct the couple, and take them to a place in which they, as the children or zeros, will be sacrificed by the one, aka the father, or God. That one and two zeros, just like you see in 100%, means the totality of everything. That is the totality of all evolutionary symbols. 100. It is the father, and then the woman and the child. So these zeros, which are not straight lines, will be physically proven to not be able to break the circle, so to speak, symbolically rendering the emotional idea they couldn't mature. Because if they can't mature, what it means is that they remain children, and the one remaining the killer is the father. That's the point. And the specific element of that maturation process, as it always goes, will be letting go in order to move on. So what we should expect to see at this location is death manifested specifically by not letting go. and moreover, death that happens inside the circle, but along the straight line, as combining the circle with the straight line, and then breaking the circle in favor of only the straight line, aka becoming the father, mimics our evolutionary narrative. Okay, so let's leave the abduction crime scene and head to the murders. How would it happen? Well, Jesse's car gets left behind at the cul-de-sac, and without any sign of tampering or struggle. By all descriptions, the car was left in a way that it seemed to investigators, family, and friends alike that the young couple had just gotten out of the car and locked the doors behind them. It's speculated that they might have been led to another car parked nearby, and then driven to the place where they were killed several miles away. But I happen to believe they were marched to the death location on foot. My reasons for that will be revealed when we talk about the three suspects. Now, in evolution, here on Earth in this era, we are undergoing a very slow but obvious transition from evolving along the ground horizontally, or Earth's surface, to evolving upward, quite literally into space, as part of an ascension narrative leading to disembodiment and immortality as the Father, or God, and therefore to get to that place in which He, the One, disappears, the zero of the binary 10 in our coding must be extracted. In that regard, again, there are three total evolutionary characters, two of which constitute the zero, and of course, one to represent the One. The One is the Father. He can't be seen, but He's the driving force behind the path forward in this universe. He wills it to happen, and we submit to that will as we are simply technology born from its desires and at His mercy. Now, the Zero characters, again, are mother and child. In our more primitive days, mother and child didn't leave the home on the evolutionary pathway of the hunt like men. They remained within the circle at home. Today it's different, and as we march toward the implementation of future technology related to AI and biological immortality, a shift will begin in which artificial replication will become preferable to natural reproduction, leading to an inevitability that both mothers and children will become obsolete, thereby also forcing obsolescence of the embodied man as well. All of which is preparation for colonizing and exploring space, a place in which humanity, specifically mortality, cannot accommodate necessity. So along the way, from our horizontal evolution to vertical ascension, we extract the circles, or mother and child, along with the man, as they all disembody to become one, or the one, going from binary to non-binary, or opening the wound or universe to healing or contracting it. Again, those children will no longer organically come from the womb, so to speak, so the father, or God, in charge of this evolution thing, forces the zeros to their death in the form of obsolescence. And the conduit by which it happens is our vertical ascension. There's no oxygen up there. So what is going to happen here is that our killer, acting as the father, is going to force the young couple to abandon the car and then the cul-de-sac, or the penis and vagina leading to the womb, and never return. That's part of going from binary to non-binary. Our reproductive systems will face imminent obsolescence over time. And that means reproduction leading to replication negates organically biological sex, if you will, meaning traditional men and women, as they no longer exist in that form, won't have sex or procreate in that manner any longer. The father, by way of evolution, or forward movement, will stop them. So, that will just manifest here. As these young lovers go to lover's lane to obviously do sexual things, the father, aka killer, comes to stop them from doing it any longer, at which point he symbolically extracts the penis from the man, taking him from the car, and symbolically extracts the woman from the vagina and womb by taking her out of the car as well, and out of the cul-de-sac. They've extracted all of the symbolic elements that create the sexual story of reproduction here. Like I said, evolution is forward movement driven by a creator you can't see, but under which you are controlled by way of his will. So here, I believe a man with a gun abandoned his car back at the cul-de-sac as well, or at least very close by, which symbolically says, in this case, that he can't have sex moving forward in the narrative. Accordingly, even though all suspects in this case were thought to have been sexually infatuated with Pat Mann, there is no sexual assault present. So, I think this man walks them at gunpoint to a remote location near the county line, meaning he was behind them with a gun, making them unable to see him, like God, while also being under the force of his will moving forward in the absence of direct communication. Naturally, he's going to take them to a place in which their horizontal forward movement makes a hard, nearly impossible transition to a vertical one, and then torture them in a way that makes a thematic statement like this. In the transition from a grounded existence to our ascension, the dilemma we face is trying to get into the air while still keeping our feet on the ground. We aren't sophisticated enough to simply launch into space and colonize at the moment, and we also aren't primitive enough to pretend that we're going to be able to stay here on the ground forever. The problem is that this transition, in terms of technology, is going to be very long and involve a lot of suffering, yet ultimately lead to our disembodiment and deification. So here, we will be leaving our human bodies behind. That's a fact. So here, we expect our killer to take the zeros to the place of transition from horizontal to vertical and make them suffer in the context of that idea until they die, symbolically extracting the zeros from our evolutionary narrative or universal coding, and thereby allowing the father or the one to disappear. And what the police will find is that the victims died because they couldn't manage to overcome the dilemma of having to ascend while keeping their feet on the ground. These are all machine-written, symbolic narratives disguised with reason and logic to be more appealing in the context of drama, sort of like adding icing to a cake so that you can't see how fucking boring the construction is underneath. That's the value of drama, of constructing a preconceived narrative to facilitate technological efficiency, but within the framework of a facade that allows perception to conduct an investigation with reason and logic to determine right and wrong rather than necessity. The evolutionary narrative is how it's built, and your perception of it through what you see, along with reason, logic, right, and wrong, allow a dramatic presentation seemingly determined by free will. Technology dictates an efficiency contrary to how we're intended to see ourselves, but necessity requires simulation, coding. Perception, however, is free will. They're opposite sides of the same coin and are intended to be. So our desires often run contrary to our needs, and the result is drama that renders tragedy when we only go after what we want instead of what we need. If we let go of what we want in favor of what we need, meaning abandoning our desires in favor of what's actually been planned for us or coded for us, then the narrative is a successful one in which we mature. But if we don't let go, we die inside, and the difference is that the successful protagonist sheds the old identity for the new one, like a metamorphosis, while the tragic protagonist simply ages and grows physically, essentially disguising the dead child who still lives inside him. A guy like that is the person who commits this crime. something happened with his father in his youth that caused this stunted growth. He hasn't become the father emotionally because of it, so he will manifest that. And of course, the suspect that I've chosen, whom we'll talk about later, is a person whose father committed suicide when he was young, and he was never quite able to get over it. He just sort of stayed in that place emotionally, and that really does fit the bill. It's not always abuse that leads to these things. It is some sort of irreconcilable issue involving the father and becoming the father. So if your father kills himself and you as the child emotionally stay in that place, waiting around for him to return and not letting go, as you age, you experience that disunity between body and mind of still being the child emotionally while growing to a man physically, making you the man-child. The purpose of these crimes is to even that out, to make you the father emotionally in a place where you were actually stunted for so long so that you will catch up to the body. So, the killer walks the couple to this tree that seems to be approximately 3 miles from the car where they were abducted. Now, we don't know how this incident began, but we certainly can deduce how it ended. We assume the killer had a gun, and we don't know if he was alone, whether he tied the couple up himself or used one of them, specifically Pat, to help. It's possible that even though Jesse was a big, strong guy, he cooperated in hopes of surviving. Did the killer get Pat to tie him up first, like the Zodiac did at Lake Berryessa, with the woman tying up the man? We don't know. Either way, the killer gets these two tied up individually and then puts them back to back on opposite sides of the tree. In the car, they were facing each other and able to come together as one. But here, the killer reverses that, putting them apart and facing opposite directions, and also changing their view from being able to see each other up close to not at all. It's basically reversing how close they were and saying you, man and woman, won't be together anymore, consistent with the necessity of our evolution moving forward into the future. And of course, in symbolism, you merely need to examine the physical properties derived from the emotional value. So here, if the victims, the police, or even we, as the public, ask why they were separated and killed, the answer will be consistent with our evolutionary narrative in the visual. So what do we see separating the two? A long straight line in the form of a tree ascending into the sky. The horizontal walk forward of our evolution across Earth's surface is over. And that's what the killer is saying here. The victims are tied up, and so the killer, along with our creator in the coding, is saying they can no longer move forward like this. Meaning human. They have to ascend. But as we are in an era of insufficient technology to accommodate appropriately and need to conform moving ahead, the creator gives us manifested horrors as a talisman of what lies ahead for us in our evolution, which is the suffering and death of humanity as it slowly but surely transitions to a form which is suitable for space. Of course, what is the number one thing space lacks that people must have? Oxygen. So you guessed it. Our victims will be deprived of their oxygen. That's how they'll die. It's simply a warning to heed the evolutionary pathway or face dire consequences, even though those things are already baked into the cake, and it's the icing on top called perception that makes us believe it's really a choice. Now, in that evolutionary narrative, by extracting the zeros and having only the one remaining, which then disappears, it means the victims have died within the circle, or universal womb. They don't transcend. Only the one does. The construction is simple. Look at the infinity symbol. On either side, you have a fixed area in the shape of a circle. They are the binary universal chambers, or universe and mirror universe, one comprised of our emotional world and the other our physical reality, which is mirrored back at us in symbolism from the values disseminated in our emotional world. The one, or disappearing straight line, which is the universe itself in one dimension, or the one, moves back and forth, like a penis, or vibrating, the basis of all evolution, impregnating the chamber with a big bang. So it goes out, and then contracts, like your lungs, or breathing, and intentionally, because at the end, it collapses and erupts once again. Just like a man getting continual erections followed by orgasms, all of which can impregnate the womb, the disappearing straight line does the same on a universal level. And that white line, like semen, is creation itself, the Father or God. So all living creatures, in terms of humanity's evolution, are intended to die within the circle, which in this case, at this time in our evolution, is Earth. It's our home. Space is the path upward, our ascension narrative. So to go there, humans have to die within the circle. And ultimately, because the universe contracts back to the point of origin, our victims will be found within what? A rope tightened around them on the tree in a circle, one from which they never escaped. They died there, within the circle, and on Earth. They're actually standing on the ground. And so what happens is that once the zeros are extracted, or the circle is extracted, we now have the two straight lines that cross, becoming the redundant ones, which just become the one. And so to symbolize that at the crime scene, after the killer strangles the two victims, he lies them down on the ground horizontally so that they create what is essentially a crucifix with the tree. And basically what that is saying, like it would in our evolutionary narrative, is that the 1-0 has become 1-1, which is the redundant ones leading to the one. And so if we look back in history, we would see the same thing. The ancient Egyptians had their version of the crucifix called the Ankh. And on the top of the Ankh, instead of the straight line above the horizontal line, you had a circle. But then when Christ came along, that crucifix became something in which the circle was no longer there, and above the horizontal line, which represents our horizontal evolution on Earth, you had a straight line ascending instead. And so that visual symbolic rendering that we see between the evolution from the ancient Egyptians to Christ is the same thing that we see at the crime scene here, with the circles being extracted in favor of the straight line, making them the two redundant ones, the dead people, becoming just one, the Father. And so again, the crucifix, the two straight lines crossing, is what indicates that evolutionary completion, and therefore, when the victims are dead, they are put on the ground horizontally to cross the ascension of the tree. These are not man-made horrors. We just manifest them. We love the drama of our perception, which is that the killer chose to commit evil acts, while the rest of us had the decency to refrain. But one look at the reality of this world shows us ugliness indicative of necessity and not choice. The universe relies on alternating current, on and off, like your lights at home, and therefore the basis of its construction requires equal good and evil, equal darkness and light, but increasingly light going toward the end, and of course increasing darkness going back the other way. It's just a balanced movement along the color scale from its bookends of black and white. So what the killer does is he ties up the victims individually and then ties them again with a rope constricted to keep them in place against the tree. From the physical evidence, it's apparent what happens next, and it matches the evolutionary necessity I just mentioned. They are inside the circle that just constricted upon them. The killer strangles each person, separately we assume, over and over until finally deciding he's going to offer the mercy of death. Investigators know this happened because of what they discovered in the aftermath. Each victim had created what amounted to what was described as a trough in mud below their feet, both areas that we assume would have been covered with leaves and other debris prior to the struggle. It seems the killer held them in a way that forced them to try to gain elevation or ascend to be able to breathe, but the only way to do that would be to, ironically, put their feet back on the ground, which would cause them to descend and have even more trouble breathing. So here, these poor victims are desperately thrashing their feet around on the ground, both trying to keep them there and also get higher and ascend, but the effort will be futile because it isn't possible to ascend very far with your feet still on the ground. It's nature saying that we, as humanity, can't have our cake and eat it too by remaining in this era of using Earth as a base from which we continually try to keep our feet on the ground while trying to get in the air. In the construction of the protagonist's journey, when you are faced with a dilemma, you must let go of what was in order to allow what will be in the context of change. So the biggest roadblock to that place is people in society believing that we don't need to extract our humanity and that working 10 times as hard to accommodate sentimentality to avoid doing what we need to do while severely limiting our potential is the right thing to do. It's not. That's the issue. We perceive the problem as right and wrong, and in the context of sentiment rather than design. And so, in the lead up to the event that happens way down the line in the story, what comes well before is something you know as foreshadowing, in which retrospect will later allow an aha moment where you see what you should have realized all along. That's a necessary but intuitive part of our evolution for most people. However, on rare occasions, we find certain neurodivergent types experience it innately and witness it explicitly. So the killer forces the manifested version of the emotional dilemma of keeping your feet on the ground while trying to rise. As is true of our plight as humans, both victims, in a desperate struggle, manage to survive for a while using that logic. And look what they're doing. What are they specifically trying to do by surviving? They're trying to remain what? Human. But before long, they succumb and suffer greatly for it along the way. So what do our victims do? They die on Earth. That's the warning we're receiving. These murders are absolutely horrifying. These people truly suffered, and it's supposed to terrify us. Yet the things I talk about here are generally absorbed intuitively and dealt with by your brain on that level, absent of your direct participation, because in truth, they are things that will come to bear way down the road. And so, again, that foreshadowing happens on an intuitive level. I just happen to see both the construction of the evolutionary necessity and the perception of the social drama all at once. But if you're someone who only perceives the social drama, as most people are designed at this time, then you will look at somebody like me and say, oh my God, this guy's crazy, blah, 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 blah. Right, but what you are doing when you engage in something like that is you're being the person who knows how to drive the car and knows what the car looks like, but when the hood goes up, you don't know shit. That's the truth, because you're not the mechanic. You can't see what's under there. So the killer disappears into thin air, or at least so it seems. Where is he? Well, unfortunately, while the rope used in this incident was recently tested by way of the MVAC method that allowed the greatest sensitivity, the condition of the material seems to have warranted only one test, a test in which all of it would be examined at the same time. They didn't feel testing smaller portions would have been a viable way of getting something usable, so everything was tested and they were unable to identify anyone. The material was just too deteriorated to be helpful, at least to that extent. But what they did gather from this testing is that there were three contributors of DNA on the sample, which probably indicates the victims and the killer. I do believe this crime suggests a profile consistent with one man, but it is without a doubt possible that two men, or even more, were involved here. So who did this? Well, the top three suspects, again, all worked in the hospital where Pat was training as a nurse, and all allegedly had a strong attraction to her. I think one of these men stands out much more than the others, so let's initially explore the first two. I'm not going to choose. Pat worked with a Dr. Wilson, and as it goes with violent criminals such as the one depicted here, often health professionals who are violent criminals or similar have frightening and ironic dimensions to their personalities, such as nurses poisoning people to death instead of nursing them to health. So here, in that regard, we learn Dr. Wilson is a respiratory therapist. It's not difficult to see the cruel humor, if in fact he was the perpetrator. As an employee at the hospital, he would have known about the dance and what time it ended. He might have very well known Jesse's car, too. Clearly, he would know about the Lover's Lane nearby, and especially because we learn he lived only a quarter of a mile from where the couple's car was abandoned. Dr. Wilson was scheduled to attend a dinner party with his family that night at the home of another family, but supposedly didn't show up until midnight without an excuse, and when he did finally arrive, he was supposedly behaving erratically, looking out windows as though he expected someone to come for him. He was later revealed to have some very strange and primitive thoughts about women, and received a lot of criticism for a book he planned to write. But most of all, he was obsessed with blondes and liked Pat a lot. This all sounds very suspicious, and there's more, of course, but despite his proximity to the crime, there really isn't anything in the way of circumstance that ties him to it. He could be the guy, but I'll pass for now. The second of three suspects, and the one who has taken the most scrutiny in recent years as the investigation was reopened, is a man named Dr. Britt, who also worked at Watts Hospital and allegedly had an eye for Pat. He was known for being a controlling, volatile personality, one supposedly conducive to engaging in violence. But here's the real issue with this guy. At a location not too far from the abduction of Pat and Jesse, some kids who were hitchhiking and unable to find a ride began to yell at refusing drivers and give them the middle finger. Eventually, one of these cars stopped, turned around and drove back, and the man inside presented himself as a police officer with a fake badge, telling the young men, or the boys, to get into his car. Ultimately, the kids refused, and because there were a handful of them, there was nothing the doctor could do. He got back into his vehicle and left. Some believe this incident makes him a good suspect, and while it is also interesting that he's a pulmonary specialist, just like it's interesting Dr. Wilson was a respiratory therapist, it's apparent that, with all three suspects, the usage of a fake police badge would be nullified by the victims knowing the perpetrator very well. Now, I definitely encourage you to look further into those two, but for my money, the most likely killer in this case is a man named James Brannon Ray, also known as Jimmy Ray. Jimmy has no history of violence, and even former lovers suggest he was never violent with them. But from a circumstantial standpoint, he is the one person who behaves in the most manipulative manner as it relates specifically to this incident. Ray was apparently obsessed with Pat while working at Watts, and she allegedly described him as a nuisance that she wished would go away. While he was an orderly and she a nursing student, he would constantly interrupt her to correct her work. He made fun of her appearance and did all the things one would do to flirt, but apparently it got more and more passive-aggressive until the point she rejected him outright and he began telling people she wasn't the nice girl she seems to be, that she had someone on the side, insinuating it was him to deal with the sting of the rejection that actually occurred in reality. He would have known when the dance started and ended, and recently stole a length of rope from a man who identified it as his when returned for identification by the police. It was something called a sizzle rope. Now, here's where he becomes suspicious on a circumstantial level. Jimmy Ray has an alibi that night, but it only runs until approximately 11 p.m., at which point there's a 90-minute gap before his whereabouts are confirmed again. Now, his first alibi isn't the greatest because he's out with a girl, and then they go home, at which point she vouches for him being there until about 11 p.m. Is that true? We really don't know, which is okay, because of what's next. Remember the symbolism of not being able to go forward and how the car represented the penis? Well, what do you think Jimmy Ray is going to use for an excuse as to why he was in the area of the abduction that night? Think about this again. If we have the car and the car represented the penis, what makes the car go forward in the same way that the penis would create? There has to be some type of fuel, right? So Jimmy says he ran out of gas. In our evolutionary narrative, once it's complete and we go back to the beginning, the ignition or Big Bang creates a circumstance in which that Big Bang or red giant replicates the universe once again. That's what happens in infinity over and over and over, eternally. When the evolutionary narrative ends by extracting the zeros and the one disappears, the place the one goes is back to the start to go from 1 to 10 once again, recreating the universe and again moving along that forward path of horizontal evolution. So when you go back to that beginning, the car, aka the penis, becomes your path forward again in reproduction, and to do so, it must be potent. So the obvious implication is that nature will write a narrative in which the thing that precipitates the Big Bang, or ignition, on the car will be the red can in the form of the gas can, or red giant, and filling it equates to potency. With that gas, the car will be able to make a very long straight line, which mirrors an erection because the universe essentially is just an expanding bridge or path forward. It's just an erection. The Big Bang facilitates creation, so fuel burns, meaning that our killer, at the end of the narrative he employed, would be faced with a situation in which, symbolically, he had run out of fuel. That's what the universe does. It expands until the point its resources don't allow it, and that expansion is simply going in a straight line. The difference is that what the creator makes constitutes the expansion of the universe outward, and our exploration of its functions forces us to reverse engineer our way back through it the other way. So our emotional lives manifest in reverse order from the elements of creation coming to bear in physicality. You see the killer employ an intuitive version of that notion by separating and turning away two people who were together and facing each other. He isn't actually indulging evolution, so the emotional movement becomes a physical circumstance in the form of a talisman about the emotional truth. So Jimmy, after the date with his girlfriend, goes back out alone, and when he does, he just so happens to run out of gas in a certain place, which is where Pat and Jesse parked. At 12:30 a.m., he shows up on the doorstep of a guy he knows and proceeds to ask if he can borrow a dollar for gas because he ran out, thereby explaining why he ran out of gas in the first place. No money. Now, guess where this person lives? On a hill overlooking the golf course, one where a person can actually see the place where both he and the couple parked. Why is that important? Well, if you abducted them there, going to high ground first and looking from a distance would allow you to potentially see any type of problem, primarily the cops being there, but of course, you could see anything else unexpected as well. So if you're Jimmy and you go to the location of this guy's home, even before you knock, you can see if all is clear down in the cul-de-sac where the crime took place, the abduction. If everything looked good, you could knock at the door and say that you ran out of gas because you forgot to bring money. If you ask for a dollar, it doesn't draw a lot of attention to desperation, even back in 1971. It's not a lot of money. So why does he ask for so little if he knows this guy? Doesn't it seem practical to get enough gas that you don't have to, like, literally go right back to the station afterward? Like maybe $5? But he doesn't do that. And why? Because the issue here is not that he ran out of gas. What he really wants is someone to drive him back to the crime scene at the cul-de-sac with a built-in alibi and excuse for being there. He doesn't want to look like he's returning from a death march with the people who are no longer at their car. He wants to seem like he went to get gas and because his car ran out. But what we still understand is that he was driving through Lover's Lane, a place known for seclusion in the way of couples, and doing it by himself, which said he had no reason to be there unless he was going to involve himself with someone or multiple people outside of his own vehicle, like those pranksters. It says he likely had bad intentions. It just so happens that the couple disappears then. Not only just a couple, but a girl from work he's obsessed with and the boyfriend he doesn't like. His own date that night is back at home. And get this, police notes suggest the woman Jimmy Ray went out with that night and Pat Mann were nearly identical. I believe the word used to describe the similarity was uncanny. These two didn't just look alike. They were basically, you know, sort of twins. A brisk, almost fast walk is about 4 miles per hour. So in the 90 minutes Jimmy was unaccounted for, which could have been longer, it seems he would have been able to walk approximately 6 miles. The bodies were discovered about 3 miles from the cul-de-sac, so that 90-minute window, give or take, leaves a nice opportunity to commit the crime, as we obviously know he's going to try to squeeze that window closed as much as possible. He doesn't have any explanation for where he was in those 90 minutes, so we can pretty much assure ourselves that it was actually longer than 90 minutes, because he is obviously going to put the squeeze on it to make it as short as possible. I'm sure he would have had a little more time on either side of that equation, as neither person supplying the alibi was suspicious of him at the time. They were both people he knew. So here he is, going back to the cul-de-sac, and without saying a word, he supplies a narrative that he ran out of gas, went to get help, and was alone, until which point he returned with gas to fill his empty tank and leave. I firmly believe that gas tank, especially given the single dollar he asked for on the verge of a gas crisis and in an era of gas-guzzling cars, was not empty, and that he realized nobody would ever check to see if it was. I mean, even the guy who drove him would see the car start only after gas was added and not before. However, if he got caught parking there without that excuse, it would have been very difficult to talk his way around the fact that a couple in a car right next to him disappeared forever. Of course, here's the advantage to walking. When they finally process Ray's car, of course, they find nothing related to the victims inside, as they were never in it. Of all the suspects, Ray is the one we can confirm to have been on foot that night in a manner that would negate evidence related to Pat and Jesse being inside another vehicle. Even so, Jimmy Ray sold that car before investigators could speak to him, and I'm talking about that same week. They were eventually able to find it, like I said, and process it, but since the couple was never inside, there was no evidence to be found. What seemed clear to me is that his haste in ditching the car didn't lie in the potential for evidence being inside, but in the consideration that it might have been spotted at the scene as it sat in the neighborhood for a significant period of time. Most damning, however, is that Ray doesn't have an alibi for the 1.5 hours between leaving his date and when he reached the guy's house where he sought gas. He doesn't even bother to try to put together an alibi for this time. And why? Because he doesn't have one, except for the truth that he had been driving around the Crowsdale Hotel alone. As we said before, the people back there in couples were looking for a good time, but the singles were seeking trouble. It's not a very difficult theme to see and understand. They're angry about being alone, or more specifically, not being with the person they want to be with. And we suffer that fate so often in this life, while ironically watching others avoid it with ease, because our Creator is saying, in bright lights, that's me. When you're the one, the singularity, or God, you are utterly, hopelessly alone. None of this is about us. It's about Him, history, His story. And in that story, no matter how many times it plays out, He's always alone, but for the reality He created in His mind, which is projected onto a physical canvas. That's what the killer does. He tries to combat the rage and anger of loneliness, but does so with inadequate tools, in the form of garbage technological means, so that what he creates, as opposed to God, is only destruction that leaves him feeling more alone, more desperate to repeat it, and searching for a way to feel whole again. Through it all, there is only one way, which is to let go. In our evolutionary narrative, at the end, we lose it all, as we do in our individual lives. And for that effort, for our pain, letting go, ironically, means that it will all come back again. That's how we get the saying, if you love something, let it go. If it comes back, it's yours. Because your Creator has built a vast, magnificent world in which you can always count on one thing in the end. Love will return, and with it comes the smiling faces of those you let go. In that moment, suddenly you'll understand why. Only that which ends can begin again. So emotionally, we let go, and physically it comes back to us. Therefore, when a killer like this strikes and does it for these reasons, he reverses that logic, and instead of letting go emotionally, he holds on physically with strangulation, and rather than those lives returning to him for choosing to mature or evolve, they're forever and irrevocably taken away. And we know the killer worried about this, about whether his victims would come back to life, as investigators discovered marks on their upper torsos that suggested they had been prodded post-mortem with a stiff object. And they were dead. It was all too real. A nightmare for their loved ones. But if there's any comfort I can offer, I think it would be this. When a killer reverses our evolutionary logic to manifest in physicality what he could not accomplish emotionally, he also reverses the process of maturation, getting the demons out of his head. He actually creates many more instead. And so what comes back to him is not love and freedom from his pain, but assurance that the long lives the victims never had on Earth, physically, will occur rent-free, emotionally, in his head. They'll haunt him, but he can't even tell anyone. He's utterly alone, lost in the woods, and in some ways realizes he died with his victims on the inside, even if his body moved on, the opposite of what he intended. While I believe Jimmy Ray Brannon is most likely the guy, it seems this case, realistically, might never be solved, and with so many of the people involved being dead at this point, including most of the suspects, perhaps the best thing we can do, at least in public, is remember the lives that were lost. So if nothing else, Jesse McBain and Pat Mann, may you rest in peace.